It's Friday, February 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, terrorism and attacks. Fighting grows between Turkish and Kurdish forces.
It was inconceivable that such a thing could have happened 10, 12 years ago. So it is quite astonishing.
President Obama plans to make an historic visit later this year. We'll find out where. Also ahead, the new push for vaccines against old viruses. Pop star Adele may be making money from singers like you. It's all on today's International Edition. Turkish warplanes hit Kurdish rebel positions in northern Iraq hours after Wednesday's car bombing in Ankara that killed 28 people and wounded dozens. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the blast, but the Turkish prime minister on Thursday accused a member of the Syrian Kurdish group YPG of being behind the blast, which occurred as military buses waited for a traffic light near parliament and military headquarters. Terrorism expert Max Abrams of Northeastern University in Boston tells VOA's Victor Beatty he tends to agree Kurdish separatists were likely behind this latest attack.
This was not an indiscriminate attack against the population. It seems to have been directed against a military target in the capital. It's true that some civilians were killed, but it seems clear that the primary target was military.
Well, this points up Turkey's on the front line of the conflict in Syria.
Yes, absolutely. Turkey occupies a very strange position when it comes to the conflict in Syria. Although Turkey is a NATO ally, many people believe that the Turks bear a substantial degree of responsibility for the creation of both Islamic State as well as other radical Sunni groups in Syria. I've referred to Turkey as the Islamic State superhighway. When foreign jihadis want to cross into Islamic State, into Syria, they get in through Turkey. And Turkey has openly sided with a number of shady Sunni groups of varying degrees of legitimacy. So although Turkey is at war sometimes with Islamic State, Turkey also bears some responsibility for the creation and for bolstering Islamic State and other radical Sunni groups. If I were to rank in order Turkish foreign policy priorities, at the top would be preventing the establishment of a Kurdish state. Then would come the removal of the Assad regime. And only after that would be combating these radical Sunni groups, including Islamic State. And so Turkey, although a NATO member, has been essentially an unreliable ally in the war on terrorism.
This all comes as the Pentagon reported on Wednesday that the northward push in Syria by pro-government forces backed by Russian air power are frustrating U.S. efforts to combat Islamic State in northern Syria.
Basically, the United States, to a large extent, has taken a back seat in terms of what's going on in Syria. The real players dictating the conflict right now are the Syrian army coupled with Russian air power. And together, they are really crushing the opposition to Assad. After all, the reason why the Russians are working with the Syrian government is to bolster Assad. And that effort is very successful, and it's really a zero-sum game with the Syrian opposition. So the Syrian opposition has literally taken quite a pounding since the negotiations broke down in Geneva and the Russians and the Syrian army ramped up their attacks.
Max Abrams says, however, not only are moderate opposition forces facing new pressure from the government offensive, he also sees a correlation between heightened Russian airstrikes and reduced Islamic State capability in Syria. He says about 12% of Russian attacks hit IS targets. Abrams says the IS group has lost territory and financing in Syria, forcing them to cut the wages of their fighters. He also sees a decline in the effectiveness of their propaganda and says IS leaders are even discouraging recruits from coming to Syria, telling them instead to head to Libya. Well, next, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, right here in the studio to talk about the Catholic Church's leader calling out on a U.S. presidential hopeful. Wow. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Yes, we're talking about Pope Francis calling Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's suggestion of building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico not Christian. He just returned to Rome after his six-day visit to Mexico, as you know, where he was very well received. And you can tell that from his tweet today. He tweeted, "Thank you to Mexico and to all Mexicans. May the Lord and the Blessed Virgin of Guadalupe accompany you always." His handle is @pontifex. Now, guys, if you're listening from Mexico, please let us know what you thought about his trip, because we would love to know. Jim, during Thursday's news conference, Francis said, "A person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not building bridges, is not Christian."
Well, that's a pretty strong statement. Mm-hmm. So what did Trump say in return?
You know, he always has a strong comeback to any of these. He has a whole statement about it. He wrote on Facebook, "If and when the Vatican is attacked by ISIS, which, as everyone knows, is ISIS's ultimate trophy, I can promise you that the Pope would have only wished and prayed that Donald Trump would have been president, because this would not have happened." Jim, it's a long response, but he added, "For a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful."
Well, what's the reaction like from the public?
Well, Trump supporters are sharing pictures of the wall around the Vatican City and telling the Catholic Church to just tear it down. One such person is Ben Shapiro, the editor-in-chief of DailyWire.com. Trump is frantically sharing these images and tweets. That's all for me today. And guys, if you're listening, please don't forget to like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/VOA.Asia to let us know what you think on this issue and also on how we're doing. Jim?
Well, great. Thank you for that wrap-up, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there at VOA Stevenson. And our program's account is at VOA_IE. Thanks again to everybody who's viewing on Facebook. Write us a question. We'd be happy to answer it to you on the air. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. White House officials say President Barack Obama will visit Cuba next month. It's a major symbolic step in the warming of ties between the two Cold War enemies. The trip had long been expected as part of Obama's effort to make as much progress as possible in improving ties with Cuba before he leaves office in January of next year. Stephen Wilkinson, an associate lecturer at King's College London and the editor of the International Journal of Cuban Studies, tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about his reaction.
Well, it's just amazing in terms of the turnaround in the relationship since the days of, you know, George W. Bush. It was inconceivable that such a thing could have happened 10, 12 years ago. So it is quite astonishing. It is rather incongruous as well, because the embargo legislation is still in place. So unless something is done to change that between now and the visit, then it will be a case of the president of the country visiting a country which it would still be illegal for its own citizens to visit as tourists, which is quite an odd state of affairs, really. But it is really quite astonishing.
This will be, however, a controversial visit because there are members of Congress, particularly those members from Florida, from the Miami area, people of Cuban heritage, not just in Florida, but others, and also, though, from human rights groups who are very concerned about Cuba's certain human rights status.
Yes. Well, the human rights groups make similar complaints about the United States' relationship with countries like China and Vietnam. But it doesn't prevent the government from having very good relations with them or even actually giving them favored trading nation status. So those kinds of criticisms, you know, leveled at Cuba, it is a different case. Cuba's record on human rights isn't anything like as bad as, say, Saudi Arabia or China's. So those kind of criticisms should be easily deflected by the president. The Cuban-American attitude as well is, well, you know, they are arguing from a self-interest point of view. It does look a little bit petty from the outsiders. When you're sitting here in London looking at it rather more objectively, it does seem like a petty objection. I think that their interest probably in the long term will be better served if there is a rapprochement, because it would allow for them perhaps to get some kind of compensation for the properties they lost in the longer term, or indeed a way back to the country that they vacated. So I think it's short-sighted of them to still stick with this attitude towards the island.
Well, and also, finally, I just wanted to bring up, of course, the U.S. still has this military base at Guantanamo Bay. You know, recently, of course, that has been a very controversial prison site in addition to other, you know, military aspects there. How does this further complicate the U.S.-Cuba relationship?
Well, it does, because it's one of the main demands that the Cuban government has placed on full normalization. They said that there can't be full normalization until Guantanamo is returned to Cuba. So hopefully, perhaps, when the visit takes place, there will be discussions direct face-to-face between the two presidents. Maybe some kind of deal can be hammered out on this and the other issues that Cuba has with the United States. So, you know, it is a step further along the way to a full normalization, hopefully. And Guantanamo must figure in that sooner or later. I can't imagine that they haven't actually discussed this yet. I think they must have, behind closed doors at some point, discussed a pathway towards full reconciliation, because that is one of the key factors involved.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wilkerson, for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you.
Stephen Wilkinson, associate lecturer at King's College London. He's also the editor of the International Journal of Cuban Studies. The Zika virus has prominently been in the news recently because of its rapid spread in South America. Newsweek health reporter Jessica Ferger joins us with more on the evolution of both the Zika and Ebola viruses and what's been done to combat them. These two have actually been known to researchers for decades.
The public has a sense that maybe researchers and doctors didn't know about these viruses a couple of years ago. But in fact, Zika was first identified in 1947, if you can believe it. And there were some researchers who were studying yellow fever in Uganda, and they isolated the virus in a monkey that was in the forest. And then Ebola also has a similar story. That virus was discovered in 1976 in the Democratic Republic of Congo in a small village. And so the thing with both viruses is that for so many decades, they really weren't much of a threat. Ebola was isolated in small villages that were really far away from overcrowded areas.
We know Ebola is a very serious disease. It often ends up in death. The threat from Zika doesn't seem to be as alarming, but it is a virus that can cause very serious complications in pregnant women and also their offspring.
The thing with Zika is that the infection is really mild, and for most people, the virus remains asymptomatic if they catch it. And for decades, nobody knew about this, the possibility that the virus could cause microcephaly, which is, of course, the birth defects that babies have been born with, specifically in Brazil right now, where they have malformed small heads, which means that they have underdeveloped brains. So because the virus wasn't seen as so serious for so long, researchers put it on the back burner and instead studied other mosquito-borne illnesses and developed potential vaccines such as dengue and yellow fever and West Nile.
These viruses, as they were originally discovered, were fairly well contained in their environments in Africa. Is it the fact that we have become just more of a mobile society that these things have spread?
Yeah, I think viruses don't know international boundaries, and air travel has really made it possible for pathogens that are isolated into very remote places to emerge in pretty much all over the world and become a worldwide threat.
These two have obviously gained a lot of attention in the scientific community to try to find a cure or at least combat them.
Yeah, with Zika, there's a lot going on now, of course. I think a lot of the scientific community and the public health community learned from the delay that they made with the beginning of the Ebola outbreak. And interestingly enough, the World Health Organization declared Zika a public health emergency of international concern a lot earlier than they did so with Ebola. And that label is basically something that is it's partially political, but it's really like what they use as their call to action.
The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, just in 2015, had a $100.27 million budget, as you write, to research projects of this virus category. Just this month, though, President Barack Obama asked Congress for $1.8 billion. That's a significant increase in the battle against the disease. There are some promising outlooks for vaccines, apparently.
When I spoke with the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, he talked a lot about this potential candidate. It was developed initially as a vaccine for West Nile a few years ago and went through three studies and was shown to be very effective. They're going to utilize the infrastructure and the research that was done on that to develop a vaccine for Zika. And they're pretty confident that the NIH will have a good candidate by the summer and they'll hopefully begin trials.
Jessica Ferger is Newsweek's health reporter. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And you may read more in Jessica Ferger's article, Ebola and Zika Are New Threats, Not New Viruses. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Lots of people love Adele's music, you may be one, and sometimes they even record themselves playing her songs and then put them on YouTube. It's a fun thing to do, but look out, VOA's Rebecca Ward tells us, if your video gets too popular, you might owe Adele some money.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering.
Adele's song Hello off her latest album 25 is one of the top-selling songs of all time. Adele's fans around the world have responded with recordings of their own versions of Hello. In music, this is called a cover.
Hello, it's me.
Lydia Lee is a high school student from South Korea. Her simple video cover of Hello in English has collected over 17 million views on YouTube. A singer named Sarah receives 5 million views with her cover of Hello in French.
Hello. C'est moi.
In Kenya, a singer named Della has posted a version of Hello in Swahili. The song has about 500,000 streams.
Hello. In me, me.
The most watched cover of Hello on YouTube, though, is from Leroy Sanchez. He's a musician from the Basque region of Spain. His cover has over 25 million streams.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all...
Karen Rodriguez in Miami works in a hotel, but she has dreams of a singing career. She competed in American Idol, a show for aspiring singers to get noticed. Rodriguez made a video of herself singing Hello in English and Spanish. This week, her Spanish version has more than 8.5 million views on YouTube.
Dicen que el tiempo lo cura todo, pero a mí me fue peor.
She thinks the song going viral will help her find an audience for her music. Word-for-word remakes of songs are allowed, but song translations and adaptations do not have the same freedom. So if you're making a video of yourself singing Hello in other languages, you might owe some money. I'm Rebecca Ward.
Well, while many of you are singing hello, we're not going to say goodbye. We're just going to hit the pause button until you can come back and join us again. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter at @VOA_IE. We invite each and every one of you to follow our stream. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, who I understand is a good singer herself. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the agreement by executive and legislative branches in Haiti on a roadmap for governing the country until a new president is democratically elected. The U.S. acknowledges the constructive role played by the special mission of the Organization of American States in fostering a spirit of consensus among Haitian stakeholders as the agreement was negotiated and finalized. The United States also echoes the core group statement of February 6th, noting our wish that all actors will keep the best interests of Haiti and its people above all other considerations. The immediate job of the interim president will be to quickly hold presidential elections, which under the agreement are scheduled to take place on April 24th. A presidential runoff due to be held last month was canceled after the second place finisher threatened to boycott the vote over allegations of fraud in the first round. Protesters took to the streets, and the perceived security environment deteriorated. Electoral intimidation, destruction of property, and violence run counter to Haiti's democratic principles and laws. The United States looks forward to continuing to work with Haiti and its international partners to further strengthen democracy in Haiti, reflective of the region's collective commitments under the Inter-American Democratic Charter. The April 24th elections will allow voters to participate in an electoral process that is transparent, credible, free of violence, and representative of the will of the Haitian people. Once the electoral cycle is completed, the United States looks forward to working with Haiti to continue the progress it has made in the past few years, particularly in infrastructure, agriculture, health, economic opportunity, and institution building. Fully functioning democratic institutions will make progress in these areas easier and more long-lasting.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.